because it has recognized that what is at stake now is no longer equal opportunity. We have a pretty good set of anti-discrimination laws now. Not perfect by any means. There's still a lot to be done, especially in the way of money for their administration and the enforcement of them by the federal government itself in the federal establishment. But the network of laws is not bad. What is needed now is human dignity, the premium upon acceptability, economic, social, academic. And here is where the Republicans can be the strongest, because after all, this is the very essential character of our party. And as I've said many times, the struggle for equality, the struggle for color blindness in American life is not a struggle for Negroes. It's a struggle for the soul of America, and will bring the party which espouses it with dignity and respect enormous credit from all the people, not just from the Negro community or other minority communities of the United States. Now I close as I began. We have a rendezvous with history and a rendezvous with destiny. It will be developed and implemented in the choice of our candidate. And really, we Republicans ought to go down on bended knee every night in the interests of our nation to pray, as Dr. Kilgore said, to pray that we make the right decision. It is that important, because that decision will mean keeping the rendezvous with the destiny the American people have ready for us or not keeping it. And we will have the same problem in our platform. And we have the same problem in our states. The states are the laboratories of the Republican Party. It is not to go unnoticed that the great strengths that we have built have been strengths in the Congress by a gifted group of young senators and older senators and congressmen who represent the new Republican. And they're not all liberals by any means. Many are very conservative. We have a young congressman in New York named Charles Goodell, who's given a wonderful account of himself. And he's a conservative, very conservative man. Mel Laird of your neighboring state has given a wonderful account of himself. The fact that I may not agree with him is immaterial. These people are productive and fruitful and are doing the things that America wants to see and hear done. And then we have our governors, who have been the most creative of all, and among their leaders have been both your governor and my governor, in Michigan and in New York, and many others of whom we can be extremely proud. So we are developing problem solving. We are developing in a most effective way prescriptions for the tremendous ills which affect our own country in its very soul, in its very heart, in its very deepest feeling. What person here, divorcing yourselves completely from being a Republican, who isn't deeply disquieted and unhappy about our condition at home and abroad? Abroad, where we're being blooded every day by a war which, on the whole, we feel we should not have gotten into. We're in it, and we're going to do what's necessary to bring us out with honor. I'm sure of that, and I join in that, but we're deeply unhappy about it. And who but isn't deeply unhappy about the condition within our own country, where it's felt by a broad section of the most activist part of the population that the only thing that counts, the only way you can win, is with violence or anarchy or incendiarism. So we have a country which is demanding some new doctrine, some new leadership. It is this opportunity to which we are summoned as Republicans in this season. I take great comfort from the fact that Republicans across the country are beginning to realize that there is very little attitude across the country of being taken for granted, that we're all from Missouri and we want to be shown. And I hope that we will not fail our country's destiny and history in the candidate we choose for the presidency. Second, I hope that within each state, as you are doing it in Michigan, we will have vigor and intelligence and high patriotism in how we carry out, especially in states with Republican governors, and Republican administrations, the ideas and the policies of which our country is capable. And third, that we will be found worthy of a unique moment in the history of the nation when we have the great opportunity to bring to the nation the new leadership which it needs, and when we have the great opportunity after such a long lapse to vindicate the two-party system, which is the most solid pillar of American freedom. And it is for that reason that I have taken such pride and such pleasure in being invited here tonight to address you. Thank you.
The beginning of winning. How can we lose? Senator Javits, for your inspiring and challenging talk, our sincerest thanks. Ladies and gentlemen, for your generous support of the Republican Party, our sincerest thanks. The meeting is adjourned.
I come to you today
however, with a note of warning and a call to action from yet another element of our society, government itself, because for so long, until within the very recent past, I have been a voice in the wilderness in terms of the business participation in dealing with the social and economic problems of our country, which theoretically were exclusively the confines of government. Because I've had this long history of speaking almost alone and then gradually seeing allies gathered together until this became the popular concept, I now see a danger creeping into the situation that government will attempt to phase out of its responsibility as business phases in, and that the problem will fall between the two stools to the tremendous harm of our nation. I see a tendency to pass the buck, as the saying goes, much too quickly from government to business. And I deeply believe that it's my duty, precisely because of the role I've played for so many years, to see that this does not happen, that with my voice and action I can help to avoid it. And it's not only my voice, but as I've discussed with you, there are things I've been trying to do in this regard, in which I hope the business community will join, because this could be a very dangerous move. Now, a few years ago, I would have come to this meeting with something of a feeling that I must exhort my audience to accept the social responsibility for business. That's not the way I feel today. This whole meeting is itself an exhortation to that end. And on the cover of your program, it's characterized, and I quote, as an urgent call for the immediate mobilization of management in the attack on urban despair and decay, end of quote. Moreover, the turnout for this conference is a testament to the fact that exhortation has already been heeded, at least by top management. I don't believe that it's any longer necessary to ask whether business should or could undertake urban action programs. You've crossed that bridge. And I believe it's approaches a commonplace these days to say that business must engage in activities related to the crisis of the city. And this conference isn't spending much time on whether. It's spending its time rather on the far more vital question of how. Now, on that question of the business role in urban problems, a much broader perspective is required. And as I generally, when I speak, try to teach as well as to learn, I'd like to tell you now that I should try to confine my remarks to 20 minutes and hope that in the ensuing 10 or 15 minutes before you have to go into lunch, you will ask some questions that I hope to be able to answer. It is very important to ask, what are the limits of the role of business, and what division of labor must exist with government, as well as with voluntary, educational, and religious institutions in this whole field? And it's equally important to ask what the prospects are for legislative action which can further assist a strong business engagement in these core city action projects. Now, let me say parenthetically that the whole influence and participation of voluntary, educational, and religious organizations has not been nearly enough emphasized. I am the ranking member of the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare and very active in its work, and we handle a poverty program. And I know how much the voluntary organizations have been overlooked in this particular situation. They're going ahead with their work, but the whole anti-poverty drive concentrated in and out of government has gone into a level above, beyond, and separate from it. Now, one of the big things that business participation should insist on and can do is the tying in of the established voluntary organizations, which have a lot to contribute, especially experience, organization, and personnel, and can be tremendously useful as an entry for business into the whole field without slowing it up at all. Indeed, I see a vastly enlarged role for the voluntary organizations precisely because of business participation. Now, that's a subject for a separate speech, But I invite your attention to that as a very important technique in what you do in this field. Now, it's very imperative, as I said when I began, that the established role and responsibility of government be kept in mind in this whole new effort to involve the private sector in this public issue. Government has its own crucial role to play, and politicians and pundits must not, in my judgment, be allowed to divert the people from holding government responsible for that role, while government romances the business community. For business cannot carry its end of the job effectively without government. As businessmen well know, the solution to a complex problem like the urban crisis requires an all points attack, a systems approach. The business role is particularly relevant in job training and jobs and in the development of entrepreneurial business opportunity in the slums will fail unless the government does its job too. Government must carry the dominant role in such fields as education, health, certain forms of job training having to do, for example, with public employment, municipal services, mass transit, crime control, and income and basic food support for those who cannot work because of age, infirmity, or responsibility, as, for example, mothers of small children. It's been said, for example, that the greatest tool of active work to relieve the welfare rolls is found among healthy mothers who have responsibilities for children who can be looked after in daycare centers, uniquely a governmental responsibility. Even in areas in which business involvement must be massive, such as the normal job training, there is bound to be a hiatus, a transition period, before business can really gear itself to do the job so that its efforts can fight adequately into the problem. In the meantime, government must continue to apply its massive resources to the problem and to avoid placing too much responsibility on the private sector before the private sector has gained the capability to perform. Otherwise, we shall have yet another example of a major program failing or only half succeeding because of an overdose of public relations promises and inadequate performance. And so, while we work with business to the full in the public interest, we must be on guard to prevent the pendulum from swinging too far away from the area of government responsibility and too much toward the private sector. And I would warn you that there are individuals, both in the federal government and in the ranks of those who aspire to be in the federal government, who have passed the buck to business. Some move in this direction out of ideological conviction, invoking the shibboleth of big government. That is, the way to counter big government is to move these functions into business. Others come to it because they're unwilling or unable to undertake the reordering of federal budget priorities, which would allow the federal government to play its proper role. Now, this reordering of priorities is sticky and crucial, and we must not let the siren song of private sector responsibility divert us from the recognition that government, too, must greatly increase its commitment to the ending of poverty and to the eradication of the slums. And I must say frankly that there's not much indication that the Congress is ready to do its share in cutting back on traditionally popular but what should be low priority programs. Now I'm going to give you some very hard examples. Last week, on the floor of the Senate, we tried to limit the amount of agricultural subsidies any one farmer might receive to $10,000 a year. That's a pretty generous figure for a government subsidy, theoretically designed to preserve the farmer's buying power, especially in the family farm, especially when you realize that there are commercial farming operations that get as much as $1 million a year in the government check. I hate to tell you, but in the Senate, that effort failed by a very lopsided margin. And in the executive branch, too, there have been some signs that the approach to a new business involvement is at least in part one of passing the buck. For example, the JOBS, the so-called jobs program, under the National Alliance of Businessmen, headed by Henry Ford, was given the assignment of coming up with 200,000 jobs for hardcore youth this summer. Mind you, we're talking here in the first days of June. In addition to the major role given to the National Alliance of developing 500,000 full-time jobs for the disadvantaged, the hardcore unemployed over a three-year period. Now it's one thing to ask business to develop opportunities for disadvantaged persons in its productive full-time workforce while government reimburses the companies for the extra cost of training. But it's quite another to go to business in a crash program and to ask for major hirings for summer jobs without reimbursement on a purely good works basis. That's not to say that business shouldn't do it, but we can hardly expect so major a response for a crash program on such terms. And not surprisingly, while the National Alliance of Businessmen has exceeded its goal for pledges for the full-year program for the hardcore unemployed, it's lagging behind very badly, I might add, especially in New York City, in its efforts to gain summer jobs. Now, what's most distressing to me is that the administration's effort to induce business to take up the slack in the summer program was accompanied by a cutback in federal efforts in the summer job area. The administration decided that it wouldn't even submit a budget request, as it did last year, for a special summer supplemental appropriation, with the result that the critical summer neighborhood youth call program was to have had 50,000 fewer slots this year than last. And yet we're very worried about a long, hot summer. It was only very recently, after intense pressure from me and other members of Congress, that money was put together and scraped from all kinds of corners to make the number of slots in the neighborhood youth corps equal to those established last year. And this was done only by cutting back on the full-year neighborhood youth program and by shortening the number of hours worked in the summer program and the number of weeks the program would take by some 30%. My own amendment was carried in the Senate to add $75 million in summer job money for this year has now been deadlocked in a conference with the House for 2 months, and we still don't get a single sign of support from the White House for this measure. Now that to me is one example of the pass the buck to business approach in action. And I might tell you that lots of other things are hung up on this deadlocked appropriation, including some $400 million in road money, which mayors, including the mayor who is here today, I think it's the mayor of Pittsburgh, and many others are weeping over, and I say to them, sure, I'm sorry for the contractors, but I'm even more sorry for the country, which is inviting some form of disaster for minuscule expenditures of this character, considering our total budget. But nobody has the courage to take the issue by the head and do something about it in respect of federal government priorities. And the buck is just being passed to business. They'll take care of it. They can't, and they won't. Now, how about the prospects for further congressional action in providing incentives and support for private action in the urban field? There's already been some very promising achievement, as you know even better than I. The most important, I think, is the development of this jobs program for the hardcore unemployed. Legislatively, that involved a major expansion of the reimbursement which could be paid to firms for hiring and training the hardcore unemployed. Indeed, I'm very proud that it was my own amendment to the Economic Opportunity Act which accomplished this change, and under which most of the money for the jobs program is coming now. Although for some strange reason, you haven't heard about it from the administration by way of explanation. In the old on-the-job training program, under the Manpower Development and Training Act, the limit until very recently was $25 a week. Under the jobs program, average reimbursement will be three times that, some $3,500 a year, and that's more likely in terms of what business can really do and its costs. So that's one set of incentives. Another set of incentives to private enterprise is contained in the new omnibus housing bill, which just passed the Senate and which has a good chance for early passage in the House. Under that bill, the government will subsidize interest rates on private mortgages down to a 1% interest level per annum, with the result that the conventional mortgage market can be made to serve the need for low and moderate income housing, both in ownership, which is the first time that's been done, and that is, you know, Senator Percy's program and Senator Mondale's, for which I give them great credit, and in rent. A third kind of incentive which might be provided, and which Congress is just now in the process of developing, is the leverage of federal procurement contracts. A few weeks ago, I was successful in adding an amendment to the $22 billion military procurement bill. I've got the word million in my text, it's billion. $22 billion military procurement bill, which requires the Secretary of Defense to take into account as a favorable factor in awarding contracts for defense hardware, the undertaking by an employer to hire and to train a substantial number of disadvantaged persons in carrying out the contract. While there's nothing under this amendment which prevents the Secretary from making his final decision on the basis of other factors, such as quality or speed of performance, I hope that this legislative mandate will induce companies to give evidence that they'll hire the hardcore unemployed in submitting defense bids. After all, most firms want to have something that a little extra going for them in bidding for a major defense contract. And the legislative language which I described should be an encouragement for them to seek out such hardcore unemployed wherever feasible. I think this procurement approach, and remember it's a $22 billion bill in 1 year alone, is most promising for the way in which government can help out in the situation. And I intend to offer legislation very shortly to further develop this idea. I shall offer, within the next few days, a bill requiring the General Services Administration to give a preference, wherever feasible, to locate new federal buildings in poverty areas and to use ghetto-based employment firms in their construction. In this way, at relatively little cost, the federal government can provide a major source of employment, of contracts, and of opportunities for the development of satellite businesses in, contiguous to, or drawing upon slum communities. Now, finally, I want to deal with what I consider to be the most important thing of all, and that is one major form of incentive which we simply have not been able to shake loose, and that is the tax incentive. I blame this on conservative minds in the executive branch and in the key congressional committees, which do not seem to understand the tremendous appeal of the tax incentive to American business, and to take a purist approach to any social use of the tax incentive system, though we have favored it many times before. Who can forget the great housing programs after World War II, when we first really began to bite into the situation because we gave the necessary tax incentives? All our evidence indicates that it's the tax incentive inducement which business best understands and most wants. The grant tax incentives for hiring and training the hardcore unemployed, or for locating new plants in or accessible to poverty areas, or for building low-income housing, offers the prospect of making social action advocates out of every corporate tax lawyer in the country. To be sure, there are problems in working out the details to avoid windfall profits and subsidies, which are not sufficiently zeroed into the target to force attention on these most difficult social and economic problems. But we have not even been able to get a commitment from the administration to study the problem. A breakthrough in this area will require a strong leader in the administration, and that leader may only come with a new administration. The further development of tax incentives for social action should be, in my judgment, one of the key priorities for the next incumbent in the White House, regardless of who he is. Now, finally, let me close by giving you a page from my own hard-learned and hard-won experience in respect of dealing with the ghetto. And I beg of you, if you've heard nothing else that I've said, and though you may think that's facetious, it's not. A speech has a tendency to slide right by you. Fix what I'm going to tell you now in your mind, very clearly. I want to talk to you about how to deal with the ghetto, as businessmen. It's vitally important for all of us to keep in mind the crucial role of the ghetto community itself in all our plans. People are very perverse. They're very marvelous, but they can also be very perverse. And the fact that we're trying to do something for them doesn't guarantee their cooperation. You all know that as businessmen in many, many things that you do. And so let's recognize and try to understand the attitude of the individual, and he is a dignified, important individual that we're trying to help. The program for this conference quotes one of the Fortune Report's conclusions, that, and I quote, "Business is the one important segment of society Negroes today do not regard with bitter disillusion," end of quote. I don't know the context of that statement and the rest of the report, but taken by itself, it's misleading and dangerous if that's all you depend on. The Negro in the slum, and especially his leadership group, many of whom are among the so-called militants, may not regard business with bitter disillusion, as the Fortune sentence says, but he's highly suspicious of it and ready to discount quickly its social action programs if they take the wrong tack. Remember, the only business ventures that most ghetto dwellers know are the commercial establishments around them, which so often victimize them, the shady credit practices and shoddy merchandise. And business has been the major target for slum riots, and they have not excluded chain stores or supermarkets. There's a latent distrust of business, as there is a distrust of other so-called establishment institutions, which could seriously undermine our efforts. I don't have any real doubt about the competence of business to solve many of the urban problems in the long run, if it has the tact and the wisdom to handle properly the community relations area. If there's one thing that could wreck a corporation's social action efforts, it's the community relations issue, as many firms have already discovered. In specific terms, this means that business must approach its social responsibility not from the point of view of doing things for the ghetto dweller, the hand-me-down theory, but doing things with it. May I repeat that sentence? Not from the point of view of doing things for the ghetto dweller, but rather doing things with it. He wants to control, at least to some extent, these new efforts. He wants to be in on the decision-making process, and he wants a piece of the economic action.